So Paul, having presented Jesus, and you won't forget the words, will you? He gave himself. That's love. And it was his love that released us. That's what Paul wants to say. He goes straight on to say in verse 6, now, all his other letters, and all letters in the ancient world, there was a system, there was a way of writing letters. And after the introduction of the person writing and those to whom it is written, in this case the Galatians, and after the way you describe those two things, invariably there was a thanksgiving, a gratitude. I'm grateful to God for what you've been, thank you for whatever it is. In all his other letters, you'll find that. You don't find it here. Paul is, he's ripping in straight away, and he starts, forgets the thanksgiving. Very impolitely, you might say, except there's more than political correctness involved here. He says, I'm astonished that you are so quickly deserting, in my opinion, he's just come back from them, that you're so quickly deserting him who called you in the grace of Christ and turning to a different gospel. Brackets. Not that there is another gospel, but there are some who trouble you and want to pervert the gospel of Christ. I think I've said enough about that already to know, for you to know who those some are. And we'll find out more about them in the letter. They're in the Acts of the Apostles too. This is this group. Why are they doing it? Don't presume they're bad. Never ever presume what people are doing that they're bad people. People do bad things. And it doesn't help to presume that they're a bad person, because that might get us off the hook. I don't know whether you think you're a bad person. I hope you don't, because you're not. We're not bad. We do bad things, and that's dangerous stuff. So these people here, let me look at the best side of it. Be those persons, because they're still in the church today, that you find them in every parish community, and we're not putting them down by saying this. People, what were they holding on to, these Jewish Christians? They're holding on to a lot. They remember their childhood, they remember their parents, they remember the beauty of Judaism, it's a beautiful religion. They remember the Torah, they read it in the thing. They remember Jesus saying, I haven't come to just get rid of the law, I've come to fulfill it. So if he's come to fulfill it, you've got to have it to fulfill it, hasn't it? They remember reading the book of Zechariah, and this filled their dreams as young children probably. And Zechariah says, the time will come when people from every nation will come and take a Jew by the sleeve and say, show us your way. They read the Isaiah, that the islands are awaiting the Torah. They saw Judaism as really beautiful, and Christianity, that's why they became Christians, they saw this as a way of taking Judaism to the world. Do you follow me? And Paul hasn't taken Judaism to the world, in their opinion. Rather, he's invited Gentiles in without the Torah, without circumcision, without all God's will as described in the Old Testament. This is big stuff. So they had their opinion. They had a solid opinion. They had the wrong opinion. And I can be excited about wrong ideas, and I think you can be too. We all can. So why were they wrong? Simply, oh, what a big question. I can't answer that question, can I? It's too big. But let's look at one aspect of it. They kept fitting Jesus into their understanding of their scripture. You can't do that. That's what Jesus' contemporaries did. That's what the scribes did. They had their worldview, and they fitted Jesus in, and he fitted nicely and did it beautifully. You remember Jesus saying, new wine needs new skins. There's something about Jesus. He fulfills the Old Testament by transcending it, going well beyond it. You look at a cactus, ugly little thing with spikes all over it, and one day in every 2 years at the full moon, this cactus produces a white lily that is just astonishing. Cut the lily from the cactus and put it in a vase, and then invite someone in to look at the cactus and the lily, and they would never make the connection. You'd never think that lily could come from that cactus. You'd never think it, but it did. Neither do you fit the lily in. The lily comes from the cactus, but I've said it, haven't I? But it is what the cactus was always about, producing this wonderful flower. But the flower is not the stem, it's the flower. Jesus is the flowering of Israel. And there has to be a leap of faith and a leap of imagination to be able to embrace Jesus, and most didn't. And even a lot of the Christian Jews who thought they did were still fitting Jesus back into their world, rather than what Jesus himself did, what Paul does, and what the Council of Jerusalem insisted on. No, Christianity does not require changing a culture. It requires changing your mind and heart to be the mind and heart of Christ. Once said, it's obvious, but don't think it was too obvious in those days. And by the way, in recent history, you go back to when the Portuguese and the Spanish, you know, and the English went out into the New World and took Christianity with them. You know those stories, I'm sure. They took Christianity. Did they also take European culture? Yes. Did people have to almost change culture to become Christian? Yes. Was that good? No. So the problem isn't an ancient problem, it's a constant problem of love. So they're the sum of the people we've heard about perverting the gospel of Christ, and why they're perverting the gospel of Christ is that they have, Paul will go on to tell us, but I'll warn you of it, they do not accept the cross, the crucified Jesus. That's the bit that troubles them. They want the meaning, they want the system, they want it all to make sense to their mind, but to dare to understand that love, even in suffering, is what Christianity is about, is a big issue, still for me, possibly for you, and when we're suffering, it becomes the key problem. And we're likely to love till it hurts and then stop. Back off love. It's fairly often that happens. Well, I don't think I'm the only one that it happens to, so. Paul goes on, even if we or an angel from heaven, angel, angelos, messenger, angel from heaven, doesn't mean an angel as distinct from a human being, it can mean that, but it means a messenger, that's what the word means, angel. Even if something came from heaven, should preach to you a gospel funny in English, it's got a whole lot of connotations, and you can't imagine Paul cursing anybody, so we better watch our English. Let me give you the Greek. Anathema, you've heard that word, it's often used in the church documents. What does anathema mean? Ana means up, and thema comes from tithemi, the Greek meaning to place. So the word itself means to put something up, let it be put up. And what it meant was, in the usage of the time, was it was forget Jesus, forget God, just take the culture. When something was anathema, it was placed apart from the community, up there, and left abandoned by the community for God to deal with, for the gods to deal with, unprotected by the community. And in a world which was often afraid of the gods, Zeus, you know, Persephone, whatever these gods were, you know, they kind of killed their first children, didn't they? Iphigenia was offered to the gods of the wind and that, so that they'd get the right winds to take them to Troy. And God, the religion can be a fear thing. It isn't for Paul. Please God, it's not for us. It shouldn't be, because God is our Father. But that's a very Christian thought. And even we can be having fear of God instilled in us, badly, by our elders. But that's pretty normal in religion. A lot of things are done by fear. Anathema meant held up. So what Paul is actually saying to the community is, of course, it's in view of conversion. It's in view of change. It's in view of knowing that God will do something with them. But he's saying to the community, in a sense, don't touch them. Don't get corrupted by them. These missionaries that are coming, whatever their motivation, don't listen to them. Put them aside, because they're teaching you something really wrong. Leave them there. Let God deal with them, and God will deal with them lovingly and hopefully bring about a change in their mind. But do not involve yourself with them. because you're listening to something that's hooking into your fear and the rest of it. As we have said before, Paul goes on to say, even, so that's the verse again, so now I repeat, if anyone proclaims to you a gospel, gospel means good news, announced news about Jesus, about God, contrary to what you received, let that one be anathema. Maybe that's better than accursed because it can pick up the meaning. And then he says, am I now seeking human approval? Or God's approval? Am I trying to please people? Says Paul. If I were still pleasing people, I wouldn't be a servant of Christ. You don't need much imagination to know why he writes that verse. Obviously, that's what he's being accused of, precisely by his people who are opposing him. They're saying to him, Paul told you this airy-fairy, mamby-pamby little religious thing where we're all loving, and he said, you don't have to do this and don't have to do that, leave that, you know, and it was exciting and lovely and beautiful things happened to you, but he was just trying to win your approval. He was just trying to be pleasing. He was just trying to have you all say, oh, isn't Paul wonderful? Isn't this lovely? He didn't give you the hard. Huh? Okay? People who like things hard, you've got to watch why. Life's hard enough without wanting it hard. So there might be something else going on. So am I still, but look at the still even. Am I still pleasing people? Is Paul saying, I'm trying to get into his psyche. You've got to do that when you read a letter. Is he saying, yeah, once I did. When I was a young man and I was trying to please the high priest and I was very anti-Christian and I was, you know, I know what, he knew where they're coming from because he'd been there. He'd done that. He knew their mind, knew it better than, and he'll go on to say, knew it a lot better than they did, because he was right at the forefront, so it wasn't as if it was new to him. I would not be a servant of Christ. What a terrible translation, but I suppose it's all right in modern English. Paul says slave, so put it in your English Bible, slave. But see, we live in a different world. Their world was, slavery was part of the system. In Corinth, for example, there were, I think, 300,000 would have been the population, 200,000 slaves. So there were two slaves for everyone who wasn't a slave, and that was fairly normal in these Roman cities. A slave was someone who'd lost a war, soldiers, wives, kids, brought in, and there would be slaves, and they would do the hard work in the city while the others stood around and discussed government and freedom and the market and all these things, the Dow Jones and these kind of things. Well, but the slaves did all the kind of, well, has life changed a lot? So, but here's Paul calling himself a slave of Christ. Now the whole letter is about freedom. Isn't it a lovely paradox? A slave of Christ. There was a song I used to like singing in my youth when I was allowed to be a bit more romantic than you are at 65. I don't know why it stops, but anyhow. I'm a prisoner of love. Do you remember that? Just a prisoner of love. I think it was Bing Crosby or somebody. A prisoner of love. Well, that's, he'd given his mind and heart and body and energy and future to Jesus. He was a slave of Christ. And in that slavery, not, you know, you've got to use the word in the culture of the time, in giving his whole will, St. Ignatius's prayer, my mind, my will, entire liberty I give to you, God, only your grace and your love is enough for me. That's the same. He's a slave of Christ, and it's in being a slave of Christ, doing the least will of Jesus, that he finds his freedom.